Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
G, take me away.
Welcome to another episode of The Gary Hour. I'm your host, Gary Levitt. This week, I talk to comedian, actor, storyteller, Mr. Gabe Pacheco. We talk about all kinds of art. We talk about performing stand-up and what it all means, what he's learned and what he's gained from it. Growing up in D.C., talk about teaching for a while. It's an interesting one. Hope you enjoy. This episode is brought to you by Future Moments, makers of mobile apps for content creation. If you're a musician, a podcaster, voiceover artist, or if you just make videos on your phone that you want to improve, go to the App Store and search for Future Moments because they probably have an app that makes your life simpler. Thanks for listening. If you scroll down, you'll see the show notes where there's links and information. You could easily subscribe or leave a review. But most of all, I just hope you enjoy. All right, Gabe Pacheco, thank you for being here.
Gary Levitt, man, I'm thrilled to be in your wonderful, cozy, air-conditioned abode.
It was air-conditioned until I just had to shut it off for this podcast, so let's get this over with.
Look, I put this the stopwatch on my phone, and we're ready to go.
Yeah, all right. Actually, I wanted to start, I like to start with a heavy question, okay?
Go for it.
Okay, so you're an actor, you've studied improv, stand-up comedian, 10 years here in New York City?
That's right. Okay. I've paid my dues. It's been more than 10 years, to be honest. I did my first open mic at Ha Comedy Club in 2004.
Okay, 2004, so do the math. That's about 14 years.
Yeah, it's been a long time. But, you know, you brought up improv and you brought up, and I did sketch. So I think I did stand up first, and then I started going to UCB shows, and I was just blown away by what I was seeing. I'd never experienced improv before that. So it was a big deal to watch, like, Amy Poehler and her crew.
You saw them?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think my grandma came to visit me in New York, and she sat in the front row with me, and we watched, pro improv show. And she's like, this looks like witchcraft. Because they're like,
how are they doing that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Cause the openings, you know, when they're sort of, they're doing incantations, and they're just like, it seems like they're really pulling stuff up out of thin air.
Good. So that brings me to the question I wanted to ask you. If the entertainment industry shut their door to you, to everybody right now, and they said, we've got enough, would the last 14 years have been a waste of time?
Oh, absolutely not, man. See, this is a spiritual journey. You know, art is a form of self-discovery, and I would be doing it anyway. So I could care less about the external rewards that come from it.
Right.
You know, and also if they shut the door and they say, we've got enough, we're done, hopefully that just discourages a whole bunch of people on the outside, and my competition withers away.
And you'll just wait for them to open the door again.
Yeah.
But it is a journey of self-discovery.
That's right. So there's nothing that I've lost from doing it. if you go, I think that going anywhere else in the country and saying, I was a stand-up comedian in New York City, that carries something that yeah. maybe is lost to other performers who live in New York right now, because we're all the fish in the water. But once you separate yourself from this fishbowl, what we do is Seinfeld the sitcom.
Right.
What we do is Crashing on HBO.
Yeah.
You know, we're living this dream.
But it does involve a lot of struggle and a lot of disappointments.
Yes. Yeah, it does. Mm-hmm. Every day the disappointments are that you're not getting more eyes on the work that you put out. You're not getting more likes on the status that you put up.
Right. I often use this metaphor of where art, you don't really get a quantitative reward, where if you're a construction person, so say I want to build a room, I can throw up insulation, then I throw up the sheetrock, I put it all in, and then it's done. And I go, look, I made this whole new room. And everyone be like, wow, that is a great new room. But you put in that amount of time, actually way more time, in maybe 10 minutes of stand-up, and some people like it, some people don't. You don't get that reward.
You can get that reward. So today I try to free write for about 30 minutes every morning.
Mm.
And I write 3 full pages. This is like out of the artist's way.
Yep. Julie Cameron, yep. The morning pages.
So I'm doing these morning pages, right? And today's morning pages, part of it, I was just thinking, I was meditating back on like accomplishments over the course of time here. And just thinking that, okay, well, there are work products that I put out. Like there was a short film that I collaborated with a bunch of brilliant performers to make called Simfeld, which was a documentary about nothing. And it was a take on Seinfeld. But the premise was that that Seinfeld and Larry David had actually purchased a show called Simfeld, written by an African-American man in East New York.
Uh-huh.
And they'd taken his idea and made Seinfeld from that. So it was kind of like this tongue-in-cheek meditation on cultural appropriation.
Right.
And also it was a story of what happens to aging artists who didn't make it.
Right.
So this documentary filmmaker goes back and looks at the original George and the original Cosmo Kramer and the original Elaine, who were part of the Simfeld before Seinfeld. And what are they doing now? So the whole thing was a mockumentary, but it really was a talking about like what happens to artists who don't get the recognition.
What happens to them?
they just keep living, man.
Yeah.
And some of them become teachers. I was playing a character, the Cosmo Kramer character, and in my version of him, he becomes an acting teacher who teaches corpse acting.
Mm-hmm.
He becomes he becomes famous for being dead on dozens of television shows and movies.
Where he's just totally still dead.
That's right. So like for episodes of Law and Order, when the homicide detectives walk in and he's the corpse on the ground.
And he's just waiting for that role where he can come alive and be an active zombie.
Wow. So yeah, the resurrection role is something that everyone that takes his corpse acting class learns about.
Right.
And that's sort of the advanced study.
They all aspire to it.
Yes.
Yeah. So this journey of self-discovery is what it is.
Yeah. And so I, you know, to go back to that very quickly, it's like, okay, if somebody says, well, what did you do in your time here in New York? I can say this, that work product. Or there's another film called Leaves in Autumn.
Then what? So you have something tangible to show for it.
Right. So, you know, a stand-up, it's a sandcastle if you're only looking at the live performance aspect of it. Mm-hmm. You're building a new sandcastle every time that you're in front of an audience. And my definition of good stand-up is creating a community where there was none before. That's your job. As the stand-up, so you're creating a collective, a community for the 10 to 45 minutes that you're on stage,
right?
Or hour, and
you're all coming together to talk about what you're talking about.
You're all coming together to laugh as one,
right? Right.
You're transmitting your thoughts and beliefs, and hopefully, all of these people around you empathize with what you're saying,
right? Which, if you go to a room of 20 strangers, what are the odds that they're all going to be on board with your point of view?
Right. It's pretty slim, and that's why stand-up seems like magic to a layman.
Right.
You know, that's why they come.
To get everyone on board.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so that is, it's great to be a stand-up, but you also have to document your work for posterity and for your own legacy.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you do have something tangible because you're now engaged to another comedian.
That's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that's something that...
Something great came out of this 14 years since that I met my life partner, future life partner.
Yeah.
My current life partner, but not quite. You know, we're not married yet.
Right. I want to ask you, how is that dating another comedian? Because there's so much that comes with that. I mean, relationships can be tricky.
Yeah.
Amongst themselves. But then being a comedian and being with a comedian all the time, that must come with extra little things deal with.
Yeah, yeah. I can just say that in the past, I dated other people who were not comedians, and the allure and glamour wore off over time because you got to be out at night.
Right.
So if you're dating somebody that's living a 9-to-5 lifestyle, they're really excited about their weekends. They're really excited about Friday night and Saturday night. And those are nights that, you know, I'm not going to be available.
Right.
So dating a comedian, the benefits are that you understand each other's schedules.
Yep.
And you understand each other's struggles to continue to maintain a creative discipline. So it's easy to say, I have to go to the other room now and write.
Right. And she understands that.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Or I've got to go on this thing that might seem like it's just a hang.
Yeah.
I got to go for a walk. Why? Because I just have to do that.
Is it tricky to put away the creative mind when you're just trying to have a romantic night?
No, because it's always fun. I mean, being so I think we're most funny when we, in high school, you're the most funny. I felt that way around like my good friends.
Right.
Just shooting the shit, talking, just freestyling with each other. So what comedy is finding a way to isolate and distill that. Mm-hmm. And make strangers feel like they are your good friends.
Right, which is tricky because you don't have all the past experiences with them.
Yes.
You're just this stranger that walked on stage.
Exactly. So you don't have to turn that off when you're around your most intimate partner. That's when you heighten it. That's when you can be even zanier and crazier.
Right. Has a lot of your banter with your fiance made it to the stage?
Very little of it. Mm-hmm. And so there's this trend in comedy where we think that comedians have created this illusion that they are on stage who they are off stage.
Right.
Or, you know, I'm just pouring my guts out on this stage.
Right, right.
This sort of like Louis model, you know, or like, you know, and what, even that is an artifice.
Totally.
That, and so you're a dummy if you fall for it. And I'm telling the listener here that it's all an artifice.
Yeah. Well, and Louis is not a dummy, even though he portrays one on stage, like just some bumbling idiot. He's probably pretty far from that.
Yeah. He he's not the only one, but I remember listening to like a, and I loved it. David Cross's, album that he put out in the early 2000s around like the Bush era, like the Iraq war. And he's talking about 9/11. And in it, he seems like really rough in his delivery, really unpolished. He's using a lot of likes and ums and whatevers. But the thing is that he'd already been doing comedy for a decade. He'd already written for Mr. Show. He was already a master performer and writer. So those ums and ahs and whatevers were like, ornamentations that he'd already put on a well-structured house that he'd built.
Yeah.
But somebody listening to that for the first time is thinking, oh, you can just go into comedy and be like, whatevs, man.
Right. Well, that's the trick. That's the magic of making it seem real casual and off the cuff.
Sure.
I saw that at open mics. People go up there like, oh, no, I'm like Louis C.K. inspired. You know, I just go up and I just talk about my life.
Yeah, you can't. So whatever, you can do that if you feel like it, but realize that the masters already learned. It's like in painting, where the masters who became abstract impressionists, they started off drawing and sketching hands.
Right.
You know, they learned all of these classical techniques.
Right.
And then went on to mask those techniques underneath these radical new ways to represent the world.
Right. So you know, you understand the rules, you see how the mechanisms work, and then you see how you can kind of bend it to do something
yes.
new, casual, interesting.
And getting back to how this relates to, you know, my fiance and I, it's my personal life is separate from my performance
mm-hmm.
and my public face.
Mm-hmm.
That's all.
Yeah, and there's none of, there's none of career competition.
No.
Because
no.
That would be the worst.
Yes. Well, we are. You know, you're just trying to. You want to be an asset to everyone in your life. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how I try not to be selfish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I never think of anybody who's successful as being an autonomous individual that's making all their own moves. The face that you see is
this
just
sounds like
the,
socialism.
It's the tip of the spear, is what right. it is. You got to have a team. Who's yeah. your team? You know, what's your support network? Everybody needs a support network. There's no lone wolves that make it out there. Mm-hmm. There's no lone gunmen either. So, if you want to get into conspiracy theories,
yeah, no, but I like how you're comparing comedy to art, because I always thought of it as art as well.
Yeah, there is commerce to it, but that's not the area that I've spent a lot of my mental energy focusing on.
Mm-hmm. When I first started doing stand-up in New York, I started to feel that it was not a positive way to be nurtured. You know, just like it's, especially when you're in the open mic world, that is just a rough, unfriendly, depressing place to spend a lot of your time. And when you say it's a journey of self-discovery, it's also a journey of being nurtured.
Well, that's why you got to get a team.
Mm-hmm.
You gotta get your team, but you also, you know, jokes aren't bad, but we're also learning how to communicate
mm-hmm.
effectively.
Right, simple and effectively.
And
simple and effective.
If something stinks, it's probably because it needs to be edited.
Right.
So I'm not the problem. The delivery was the problem.
Mm.
The product I put out was not done.
I like how you put that, because you're separating yourself from the art. You're taking your ego out of it.
Yeah, it's not personal mm-hmm. when something sucks. It just
but
means...
What if you created it?
You know, here's... Every mountain is made out of grains of sand.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that every day working on something is what makes it good. An example is, let's say you and I have, we have to read, we're going to do a table reading, and you've never seen the words before, and you're not great at reading out loud.
Mm-hmm.
So we sit there and we both read this script together, and I fumble over the words, you fumble over the words, and somebody sees it, a third party, and they're like, well, you guys are terrible actors.
Right.
Are we? You don't know if we're terrible actors or not. This just wasn't ready yet.
Yeah.
So, but if you had a night to read the script with your partner, your fiance,
yeah,
and you read the script 100 times with mm-hmm. them, and you got it up on its feet, and you memorized the words. Now you've got the words. Now you can play with it. And then we come in and we do this audition again.
Right.
That's how I look at whether or not stand-up is... I go on stage and I tell a story, and I don't even know why I'm telling it yet. I just know that it happened to me, and I have emotions around it. And then I get a couple laughs,
yeah.
and then I go up later that night, and I'm like, okay, this part was... It ran too long. Let's just try to make it shorter.
Right.
Okay, and then the next day I go up and I go, oh, what's the opening line to get people hooked?
Now, what are you using as your yardstick to measure what to edit, when to edit? Because audiences are so different.
That's a good question. I think for me, I want to have punchlines close to the end of everything. Mm-hmm. And then if I have an aside in this story, mm-hmm. why am I telling that aside? That aside better also have a point that it's making.
Right.
You know, and then, so I've been telling a story for like 3 weeks now, and I finally got into a place where I can say, oh, I've got some symmetry between the beginning and the ending. Mm-hmm. And by telling this story at mics, mm-hmm. the mics have sharpened it up so that I make sure that I have punchlines throughout. And then I've been telling it at storytelling shows, and that has made me compare it to how other storytellers have sort of different acts to their story, or they have a lesson that they learn at the end. And even though I don't have a profound lesson that I learn in my story, I'm able to couch it within those parameters.
Are you adding jokes in for the storytelling shows?
Oh, dude. As a stand-up, go do storytelling shows.
Because you're
You'll always
this...
crush.
Yeah.
I know. Yeah. Especially after like a really sad story. Mm-hmm. Like somebody tells the most awful like first sexual experience story, or right. like getting arrested, and then, or someone dying close to them. And then you just go up there and smash with like punchline. Mm-hmm. Really diffuses the tension in the room. Everyone's mm-hmm. really grateful.
Do they resent that you're using their storytelling medium for stand up?
I don't think so, because I honored it enough that okay. there's one thing that I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. I don't finish with a story and then start something else.
Right. It's not like just, oh, then I was at Thanksgiving dinner and hey, you ever ride the subway?
That's right.
Yeah, they don't do that. Just to harp back on the first question a little bit, it's a journey of self-discovery. Can you elaborate on what things you've learned for yourself that you think stand-up and acting have specifically given you, rather than just living 14 years on this earth?
Yeah, it's a little bit like working. I don't know. It's what can I say? It's a little bit like working out mm-hmm. or playing a sport. And you build these different behaviors and habits and strategies around any sport that you play. Like, let's say you play chess. Mm-hmm. And in chess, it's thinking four moves ahead. Let's say as a simple thing.
Right.
Or learning how to use a variety of different tools around you that each have different properties. So it's like learning how to manage a team. In that way, being a stand-up has taught me a variety of things, be it how to promote yourself, how to produce events, how mm-hmm. to promote events,
right.
lighting.
Right. A lot of skills that take you to, that are applicable in other mediums.
That's right. Yeah. Branding.
Branding and marketing are huge.
Copywriting, editing any writing. I've been able to extemporaneously just talk, give speeches at weddings and funerals, mm-hmm. and any
you crush
sort of
at funerals.
they do. Humor crushes at funerals. Nobody wants to hear sad stories at a funeral,
right?
You know, even if you're telling anecdotes about missing someone, the more ways that you can add humor into it, you know, it's you're there to uplift. Even a funeral is also the creation of a community where there was none before. Mm. It just so happens that someone had to pass for all of these people whose lives were affected by the person who died to see each other.
Right.
So it really is, as much as a celebration of that person's life, it's seeing all of these other people for the first time.
Right.
You're now tied together as a community by this person's absence.
That person brought all the people together.
Yeah.
Even if they were a divisive fuck, they brought everybody together in that moment.
Yeah. Sometimes the biggest monster can bring everyone together finally.
Yes.
to work towards some changes.
It all ends the best way it could possibly end.
So there's some I'm a glass half full, I guess.
You are. You're an optimist.
Sure.
So these are life skills that you learned, right?
Yeah, and also getting rid of the filters. Mm-hmm. How many filters do you have in your life that you put up that keep you from that where you're policing your own language, where you're policing yourself, and how many facets of yourself have you actually explored? So I think that the act of being a stand-up means that you're going to focus on things like your impending mortality, and you're going to write jokes about it, or you're going to focus on all of the issues that you have interpersonally that have caused every relationship up to this point to crumble and fall apart. And you're going to find a way to communicate these sort of universals to this audience in front of you.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And it gets boiled down to, so I'm on Tinder.
But there, you are forced to face yourself in an honest way.
Yeah.
You studied improv, and you probably learned this from improv, that you just have to be as honest in the moment as you can. And in stand-up, people sense when it's not improvisational. And that's part of the magic of stand-up, is making everything you're talking about seem like it's the first time you're talking about it. It's just coming off the... You're just rolling with it up, right off the top of your head.
Yeah.
And once people sense that it's rehearsed or it's been said before, they might tune out.
Sure, sure. I could see that. I don't know if I feel that way personally, because I am a fan of stand-up. And I think that it's... When I started watching it, I watched it on television. And television and movies, watching a stand-up movie, those are... It's like a cold medium. And so when I'm watching it on TV, I know that it's not the first time.
Right.
That illusion's already been broken.
But,
so
but you're more introspective than most people.
Sure. Or you watch George Carlin, and there's no way that those lists are off the top of his head.
Of course, right. But I'm sure you've done shows where... You're doing, maybe you're doing a material even, and the audience is laughing, whatever, and then you'll just improvise something in the moment, and then that gets a huge laugh.
Right.
And you're like, what the fuck? Fuck you guys. Like, I just worked on this material for a year, and then I just improvise something in the room, and that gets a bigger laugh? Like, no.
So I was listening to a Bill Burr album, and this was like right when I started, maybe right before. And I'm thinking about doing stand-up, and there's like two tables, and it's like a black table, and like, I can't remember why, maybe he said his grandma was racist in the bit, and there was a rejection by the audience to hit what he was bringing up.
They rejected his premise.
Yeah, there was some outrage early on, and he... You know, stops and talks to them, and he's doing all these jokes that are like riffing and crowd work. And I'm listening to this, and I'm like, this is the most daredevil, Evel Knievel thing. At like, what? You plan this album to record it, and you're just willing to go off script and just veer into this unknown territory. And I thought that was so brave. And again, I didn't know anything at the time. And you can be a master at crowd work now, and you've done, even crowd work is muscle memory.
Because you have the responses already prepared.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Or you're so devoted to, you know yourself so well, and you're devoted to the values and the point of view that you're conveying with your act, that it doesn't matter what anybody says to you, because you're always in character.
Right. One skill I feel like I've gotten from performing stand-up and being on stage and gauging an audience is that I've gotten really good at gauging people. So maybe when you do that kind of crowd work that you're talking about, you kind of know who to call on, because you're like, oh, that person's wearing that kind of thing, he'll probably say this kind of thing.
Yes.
You get really good at that with addressing audiences all the
time. And I think a difference between what he was doing, what happened is that this Bill Burr bit was like, he didn't ask for a crowd to talk to him. They were heckling him. So now he was dealing with that heckler.
Right.
And finding a way to get them re-engaged or shut up, and then get the rest of the crowd back on board.
Yeah.
And I thought that was both so scary, because I hadn't started doing this yet.
Right.
You know, and then now even thinking, well, would I want any crowd work on my albums? I don't know.
Why do you think it is that audiences respond to that moment of improvisation?
Well, the live audience, that's what they're there for. You know, they're there for, like, stand-up is a hot art form. It's a hot medium, a live performance. So I think it's actually been, it's to its detriment that it's on television so much. You know, I think that when people go out, they want to feel like they're really connecting with this another mammal who's in front of them on stage.
Right.
Who they can see the sweat on that person's brow. And you guys are all engaged. There's the same smell. Everybody's got the same smell in the room, right?
Right.
Maybe it's the free pizzas from the back of the bar that you can smell coming from the oven. All of that. We're all experiencing the same humidity or the same dripping air conditioner.
Right. It's like I have a line that I use sometimes. I'll be like, all right, this show, the show is totally live.
Mm-hmm.
People are like, they're like, it's like a weird thing to say at a stand-up show.
Yeah.
And then they kind of laugh or just like think it's bizarre. But I think you're right. I think people are there for the live, anything can happen sort of thing.
Sure. And in a live stand-up show, it doesn't have to be like 10 laughs per minute.
Mm-hmm.
In a live stand-up show, you can watch a performer dig a hole for like... And there were some brilliant comedians that I watched starting out, and I was so astounded by like how long they could sustain no laughter. Mm-hmm. And this but it's not no laughter because people aren't engaged. They are like dead silent watching or squirming. And then three different threads of ranting are pulled together and tied into a nice little bow at the end, and the whole room erupts in this massive cathartic laugh.
Yeah.
That's so much more satisfying than like a titter here, a titter there.
Yeah.
And at the end of it, they remember the comedian's act because they've had so long thinking about it. Every time somebody laughs, they're forgetting everything that you've said.
Hmm.
You know?
Interesting. They're also forgetting their worries, at least for a moment.
Right. So it's a mix. Can you, you know, if you can do both, if you can get those like laughs per minute, but then you can also sustain some tension and silence and then get a whole room laugh, you're...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I often say like what I'm trying to do, a barometer for a good stand-up bit is, I've seen so much stand-up obviously, but I want people to remember a certain bit.
Yes.
And, you know, when I've seen so many comics, but if I remember a certain bit of someone, that is like, whoa, you've just gone to the top of my list of like, oh yeah, I remember that bit. That's something to really kind of aspire to, because you can get laughs is one thing, but...
Well, think about this. You got to sing it, man. You got to sing it. Even if it doesn't sound like a song,
uh-huh.
Your bit should have a melody.
Right. Oh, the rhythm of the delivery.
If you got a rhythm,
yeah.
You got it. It's like having a catchphrase.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Since you did study improv, I feel like I've studied improv too. And I feel like that's kind of such a great lesson for everybody. Everybody should yes and, because so many people aren't good in conversation. It'll make you a better texter. You know, I don't know if you did the dating apps or stuff when you were dating.
Oh, I didn't. I refused. One, it was just easy to meet people in real life.
Right.
So I never, you know, not to brag, but it was, you know, when you're doing stand-up, you're on stage, you're performing all the time. So why? I'm just meeting people.
You don't want to use them just to get material?
No. I never thought. And the other thing too was if somebody wanted to text me before we met, I thought my words were too valuable, honestly, to like give away to somebody I didn't even know.
Right.
So I was like, you haven't earned, I have no emotional resonance with this like avatar on my smartphone screen.
Right.
So they're not going to get my words until like we have to meet in real. I need to meet you first.
Right.
That was my mentality.
Well, that's kind of the digital age, and how I would think of it at the time was like, okay, it's like we're meeting in a bar. I'm looking at you from across the room. There you are on my screen. Now I'm deciding, hey, I'm going to smile at you. So then I'm swiping right. That's my smile. And now if we've matched, you've smiled back at me. I had this all worked out in my head.
Yeah.
A Tinder match for me was like being in a bar, but I didn't have to like get dressed and go out.
You did it. You were great. That's great. You were great at it.
How I rationalized that?
Yeah. You really, I mean, that's like an actor looking over a script and like finding anchors and emotional resonance to like.
Or is it delusional rationalization?
We're all living in our own dream worlds. So yes, it is both, but it was useful and it worked. It was pragmatic.
It was productive.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I can't do it. I'm like,
well, you're engaged to be married. So
that's right. That's really right. I found it. And I've met her at a show. So, and she, you know, she was just sat in the front row a couple times.
with you on stage.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, and it all worked out.
Do you think you'd be able to be with someone that if you didn't like their stand-up?
What if you
liked them as a person, but you didn't like their stand-up?
It's tough. It's tough to... Here's what I think. I'm an optimist, and okay. so everybody can get better.
Mm-hmm.
So stand-up is a way of shaping your... It's a living document. Your stand-up is a living, breathing document. So if somebody's like a year into stand-up, they're going to stink, man.
Yeah.
No matter what.
Yeah.
Because even if they've got great ideas, they're not executing them perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
So who cares? So let's say it's somebody who's like a newer stand-up. It's fine. They have to show a potential for getting better.
Right.
That's all I care about is potential.
Yeah.
But that's how I feel with like every relationship I'm in. I just want to see people growing. It's like, do you hang out with stagnant friends?
Right. Yeah.
No.
Exactly.
You hang out with people who are killers.
Yeah.
Striving.
Yeah.
Doing pull-ups. They got pull-up bars.
They're trying to grow as people.
Yeah. They're doing new things. They're taking new classes.
Right.
So, you know, a sense of humor is something that is in, you need to have, they needed to have that.
Right.
But do they need to be the best stand-up? No.
Yeah.
Yeah. They'll get it if they're trying. And if they quit, that's fine. Are they doing other things?
Right. But then it's also like you kind of wouldn't even be attracted if they were bad at if they were just bad at stand-up or their art in general wasn't good.
Right.
It probably wouldn't be someone you were attracted to anyway.
Exactly.
Because they go hand in hand.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was... I don't think if I met somebody, let's say I was single now and mm-hmm. I met a comedian that was like, you know, 10 years in and I didn't like their stand up at this point.
Yeah.
It's over.
Or no, would never start.
Probably. Right. Because what have you been doing for 10 years that you haven't learned anything
right.
about? Or they have learned and they've got all the skills and techniques. Mm-hmm. I'm just not a fan of the energy. Mm-hmm. That they are displaying.
Right. The material, their point of view.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're from Washington, D.C.
Yeah, I was raised in the nation's capital.
Uh-huh.
Totally. Right next to the Jefferson Memorial.
Yeah?
But yeah.
You went to high school there and everything?
I did. I went to high school in Bethesda, Maryland.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I always imagine growing up in D.C. must be a bit like growing up in Los Angeles, where like the Hollywood cloud would be over you, except in D.C. it's just this political
cloud. Oh, yeah. It's like it's a cloud made out of beige khakis and like navy blue.
Golf carts driving by all the time.
It's just, oh, my God. Everybody's it's like jogging clothes. Everybody jogs.
Yeah. But is everyone involved in politics?
Think tanks. Yeah. No, there's no industry outside of politics.
Right.
So it's all politicians. It's all consultants.
Mm-hmm. Lobbyists, journalists.
Lobbyists, some journalists. Journalism doesn't matter anymore. It's dead.
Oh, let's not even get into that.
But journalists too, like Washington Post was huge for me. We had like tons of newspapers in the house all the time. We tried to stay informed.
You don't think the Washington Post is dead right now?
No, it's fine.
Okay,
it's fine. Good. I wish that they let me read more of their articles for free because they're always advertised on Facebook and then
right.
I click on it and it's like, subscribe. And I was like, no.
I know. I'm a little torn about that because I want to support good journalism.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Well, they all played themselves. I'm just like, come on, guys.
What do you mean they all played themselves?
Well, all these newspapers amplify nonsense politicians, and they gave them free press up through the election.
Right.
And we are where we are now.
Right. Yeah, it's like they're guided by the click, so which would mean the most sensationalist headlines.
That's right. And they're all owned by, they're all owned by businessmen.
But that's even more reason to support them so they can operate with a little more integrity if they don't need the dollar.
Yeah. who knows? Who knows? I remember listening to another episode you had about a comedian who lived in D.C.
Uh-huh.
And I also, having lived there, find I'm very political in I'm on the Katie Halper Show, which is like on WBAI radio, and we like to interview a lot of local politicians and talk about a variety of issues. I care more about issues than I care about specific politicians. Mm-hmm. So growing up in D.C., it was like the murder capital of the U.S. when I was there, and the streets were flooded with
any reason.
Crack, cocaine, okay. So much crack.
And you left, the murder rate went down.
Right, that's right. I was just killing him on stage, son. No, before I did stand up. So I live in D.C. and I was, and it was a very unsafe city in three quarters of it. And then the area where I lived was relatively safe. I lived in Northwest D.C., right by the National Zoo. But I saw, like, just, it was just seemed so crazy to me to drive around the city or walk around the city and see these empty buildings in the middle of town, like, you know, within blocks of the Capitol. Mm-hmm. So we live in the great, and I'm hearing in school that this is, like, the greatest country in the world. And we're, and no matter how bad it seems here, it's worse everywhere else.
Right.
So that's the narrative that you're raised with in school, that I was getting this nonsense. And I thought, why is it so bad? Why is the murder capital? Why is this the murder capital? Why are there empty buildings?
Why are there empty buildings and homeless?
Yeah, so that made me very critical of, like, the war on drugs. They also had a curfew policy for young people.
What, really? There was a curfew for young people?
Yeah, and really it was just, like, to police, like, black adolescents. So keep if you're, like, black and a teenager, like, you can get stopped on the street.
Was the curfew only for black people?
No.
What year was this?
No, but it was.
Right, right.
You know?
So there was a curfew for if you were under 16?
Yeah.
What was the curfew time?
I think it was probably like 11 o'clock.
Wow.
So, but whatever, the city was a police state.
Right.
But only a police state for a certain part of the community.
They only enforced it for certain
parts.
That's
right. That's right. And the cop, yeah. So you just see, I saw a dysfunctional local government. I saw that DC is like an internal colony as well, because there's no vote. The votes don't matter in the city. So I see some kinship between Washington, DC and Puerto Rico. And Mayor, and I watched this fantastic documentary on Mayor Barry, The Nine Lives of Marion Barry.
Yeah.
And he, you know, things turned out really poorly for him. Because of alcohol and crack. I think alcohol more than crack. I think you just start drinking it, and drinking is like the gateway to like lowering your inhibitions to do other things that are going to be destructive.
Right.
So he just couldn't stop with that. But when he started, you know, he had a lot of really great, he came in and his administration addressed a lot of issues that were problems in DC. How it was there was no autonomy within the city government.
Now, Marion Barry was the governor?
He was
the mayor.
He was the mayor of D.C.
Mayor of D.C., and he got caught on camera smoking crack.
He got set up. Yes. He did get caught on camera.
But then he came back and ended up being mayor again.
That's right.
Oh, my God.
That's
great.
Right. But what people don't realize is that he had built up a lot of social capital in, like, the 20 years before that. He had a PhD in organic chemistry, so he was an incredibly smart guy. He was an academic. Then he became a civil rights activist, and he's in D.C. working, wearing a dashiki, you know, out there in the streets. Mm-hmm. And then he's working to get local control of the government, because it was being controlled by, like, sort of southern white police officers and congressmen,
right,
who were not from the area, who were making all the decisions for the people within the city. And then he's actually wounded. He gets shot while he's in public office before he's a mayor. He's, like, working as a city council.
Someone tried to shoot him?
He gets shot in a holdup where this group of black militant activists, it takes over one of the, I can't remember, it's like a municipal building.
It wasn't his crack dealer trying to get his money?
No, man. But so he took a bullet for the city.
Uh-huh.
And he was, and that, so his popularity as a scholar, a civil rights activist, and a local elected official who gets wounded in the line of duty, propelled him to become the first black mayor of D.C.
Mm-hmm.
All of that, up to this point, is huge.
Yeah.
And like so many civil rights activists in the late 70s through the 80s, you know, he got felled by the government and drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So he definitely had his own demons. But yeah. I can see why people voted for him again after his first slip.
Because of all that.
Yeah.
He was very well liked, huh?
He was very well liked, yeah. He wasn't liked by white Washingtonians.
Right.
Who were like kind of, it was kind of like the OJ thing.
Yeah.
You know, where they're like, what? He's got caught on tape. We know he did it.
Right.
And yeah, but you know.
So growing up in DC, he was your mayor for a bit?
Oh yeah. He was my mayor for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And
did you ever think of going into politics, or did you become completely jaded from politics being in DC?
I got completely jaded from, like, you know, the it is a swamp.
Uh-huh.
It is a swamp that needs to be drained, and no one's ever drained it. And there was cynicism on both sides. I grew up there during the Clinton era.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it doesn't matter. It felt a lot like the comedy community in New York City. So like I didn't have a village of generations of family and friends. What happens is that my parents lived there, and that every 4 years there would be a brand new group of people who got their jobs because they got appointed by somebody that got elected.
Right.
So it's the cronies of whoever is in power moved to the city.
Right, so you don't get like generations of people born and raised and growing up in D.C.?
Yeah, you do. There's the African-American community has more of that.
Uh-huh.
But if you're like part of the sort of this professional class of lawyers and journalists and lobbyists,
mm-hmm.
you're coming from the other states.
Right.
And you're coming because you're a Democrat or you're a Republican, just got in power,
right.
And you're there for their administration.
It's very similar like that in Los Angeles, except for a lot of the Mexican South American culture that has just been there for many, many years.
Yes.
And
yeah.
Then you have all these people coming in to try to become actors and screenwriters.
Right. So it's LA, but for like policy wonks and for think tanks.
Every 4 years, you have a new neighbor.
Yeah, totally. So the neighbors on both sides of us are constantly changing.
Uh-huh.
And the house we have in Woodley Park.
Uh-huh. Now, you're of Mexican heritage?
That's right. My dad is, he was he is Mexican-American, you know, born right on the border, and his parents were migrant workers, so my grandparents, both from Mexico, migrant workers, didn't speak English,
mm-hmm.
And then he moved to D.C. to follow my mom in the early 80s.
So who was the first to become an American?
He is. It took a very long time to find that birth certificate, though.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
What do you mean he couldn't find his birth certificate?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, the border's a funny place.
Uh-huh.
So.
Well, was he born in Mexico or
I don't know. Well, there's a.
You don't know? Or
there's, hey, he's got a social security number. He's uh-huh. good. He's good.
Yeah, okay.
That's all we're going to say about
so
that.
So I don't work for ICE.
No, we're all good. But, you know, there is this idea that Mexico was at one point all of Texas,
mm-hmm.
you know, California,
yeah.
New Mexico, Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
So part of me doesn't care what happens in the United States.
Mm.
Or in that land is,
right.
is still contested land.
Sure, of course.
So there is an internal colony of Mexicans that live in the U.S. that have always been here territorially, but the border moved. They didn't move.
Yeah, I mean, I lived in California for 8 years. I could definitely vouch that half of California looks pretty much like Mexico.
Yeah. Yeah, and on the East Coast, that's a weird thing because, like, I didn't grow up around other Mexicans. They're, like, the closest analog was the Salvadorian community that moved to Washington, D.C. in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
There was a civil war in El Salvador when Archbishop Romero was assassinated, and Ronald Reagan was really into suppressing communist popular uprisings throughout mm-hmm. Central America. So he was funding all these death squads throughout throughout Central America, and there were like 100,000 Salvadorians moved to Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm. You feel a kinship with did you feel alone, basically, and not having a lot of Mexicans around? And
well, no, I mean, so I went to a bilingual elementary school, which was pretty cool, and so I met a lot of the Salvadorian community there, mm-hmm. and I met a lot of like Mexican American professionals who were coming from Texas and California and Chicago, who would work in the administrations in DC.
Yeah.
So, like, here, it's funny. Like, you meet the best and brightest from all over the country living in D.C.
Yeah.
So, all of the Dominican and Puerto Rican people that I ever met in D.C. were professors, poets, lawyers, doctors, mm-hmm. And politicians who were coming to lobby. So, from all over, that's kind of the feeling. It felt like it was like the Cosby Show without, like, you know, what Cosby did.
Yeah.
But this sort of like excellence of, because that show sort of represented what a minority professional class would be.
Yeah.
You know? So that was the vibe. And then, you know, I moved to New York to go be a public school teacher, and I knew in theory about like poverty.
Right.
But I was like, oh, wow, look at like the conditions in the Bronx are crazy.
That's where you had to teach your first years?
Oh, yeah. I taught in the Bronx for my first 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Which is the roughest, probably.
Yeah. And when we say rough, it's like rough to me is that there just are not, there's just not access to opportunity, and there's not access to
hope.
Yes. Yeah. Like the environment is awful.
Yeah.
So the people are fine. Humans are humans wherever you go. Mm-hmm. So it's not their fault. They're not. I'm never going to come in. I don't like it when comedians, and I have been guilty of it, but just sort of like, sort of dog whistling, like, I was in Harlem, you know what that means? Or like, I was in the Bronx. Oh, those kids. And it's like, no, the kids are fine.
Right.
It's that there aren't Xerox copy machines that work. It's mm-hmm. that they have to walk up 5 flights of stairs to get to their classroom. Right. It's that there's splinters in the doors.
Yeah.
It's that they came to school hungry. And when you've been hungry, you get hangry.
Yeah.
You know? So there's a million things that are going to make people not put their best foot forward.
Right. And that's like the nurturing I was talking about before, when you're exposed to just a lot of violence, a lot of anger.
Yeah.
That's just, you become that.
And yeah,
it just cycles again.
And you project, and we never point at the right target. I think that it's very easy for humans to transfer their negative emotions and feelings to those closest to them
mm-hmm.
who look like them, or right. that they feel like they can be aggressive towards and not face consequences.
Yeah. Yeah. Man, how long did you last teaching? First of all, you must have been pretty young when you were teaching.
I was super, super young.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what I was doing, and I was still a kid.
Mm-hmm.
So I taught for 2 years there, and then I totally burned out. And part of it is that the New York City Teaching Fellows Program has, you're taking classes at night as well.
Uh-huh.
So I'm waking up at like 5 a.m., and I'm going to teach from 7:30 or 8 in the morning until 3:30, and then I can't even prepare for the next day because I have to take a bus up to Lehman College wow. to then take my master's classes. So I'm done by like 8 p.m. and it's pitch black because it's October, November,
yeah.
and it's starting to get cold,
mm-hmm.
and it feels like midnight.
Yeah.
And I haven't done a single joyful thing all day. And then I would come back to my apartment and ruminate and listen to comedy albums.
And this is before you wanted to be a stand-up?
I started doing it around this time. I went to my first mics.
Mm-hmm.
So when I started, I wasn't like jumping in with both feet. I was like, put a toe in. And I was like, I'll try this open mic at Ha.
Right.
You know? And then after my first 2 years teaching, my roommate, she quit teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, okay, well, I was like the senior teaching fellow in the building by the end of my second year because people were just like dropping out halfway
high
through.
Turnover rate.
It was like teachers were dying, not because they were getting killed or anything, but like I had a teacher who I saw every day in the teacher's lounge, and then one day she just didn't come in and she passed away, a young woman. And so I was like, I had like a mortality thing
right.
too, where I was like, do I want to just like not show up one day in the teacher's lounge?
Right.
And that be it.
Would she die of a heart attack because it's that hard of a job?
Yeah, like people had nervous breakdowns and stuff. It was just a really stressful environment to be. So,
was your first gig at her funeral?
I didn't know her that well. That also made me sad too, is this anonymity that we, you know, you're still alienated from your coworkers a lot of the time, because most teachers are very isolated. You spend your day in your own room, mm-hmm. with only children.
Right.
And so you're not practicing being with other adults.
Right.
You're not practicing interacting with your peers.
Yeah, you're not having an adult conversation all day.
No, you're managing 30 still forming, right, humans.
What grade was it?
So I taught 6th, 7th, and 8th grade.
Okay, yeah.
And 7th is the wildest. But I'm super comfortable around 7th graders now.
Right.
They're my favorite. But that's like the Joker year. That's the year where you're like, you just want to burn it all down. Because 6th grade, you show up and you're still like fresh.
Right.
To you're the littlest fish. Mm-hmm. And those kids are like looking up to the adults for protection. And, yeah, and sort of they're still looking to role models. And they're behaving with elementary school like rules and protocol. And then 7th grade hits. And 8th graders, they're bigger, but they have some role of responsibility in the school. Yeah. They're the role models. You got to look up to them. And they know that they're about to advance into grown-up high school. So they actually carry a little bit of maturity. 7th graders, though, it's all hormones.
Right.
No consequences.
Yeah. So, terrible combination.
Dude, yes. The fights. So many fights in the hallway.
Yeah.
And just loudness and just general personal instability. Because you're like, one day they're totally calm. And then the next day, they have a growth spurt or like some hormone,
right,
thing happens, and they're like crying for no reason in class.
You're, yeah,
like,
oh. What happened?
Yeah, and then the other kids just start mocking them.
Yeah, and they have identity issues. They don't know. Yeah, who they are yet.
They don't know if they're gay. They don't know if they're straight. They don't, mm-hmm, know if they don't know anything.
Right.
They're just blobs of feelings.
Yeah, learning about science and history is probably pretty low on the interest level.
Absolutely. Yeah, and then it's not connected to their real life.
Because, at all, yeah.
Because they're in, because they've got other things, other pressing issues.
The journey of self-discovery.
Right, they should all have to do the artist way. There, yeah, should be, honestly, I'm like, every student should, the first thing in school during the day, I think would be great as a sport, mm-hmm, or some sort of physical activity,
yeah,
where everyone's just got to run.
You know, I've said this on the podcast before, but I used to have, in elementary school, I had a lot of behavioral problems.
Yeah.
And I couldn't sit still, and I'd make jokes in class, and I'd speak up. And then I figured this out, like you said, I'd get off the bus, and instead of going into homeroom, I would just run around the block as fast as I could. I'd sneak away and run around the block as fast as I could, mm-hmm, and exhaust myself. And then my behavioral problems were fine. That's, yeah, all it was.
Yeah.
These kids need to burn off energy.
You run for half an hour, and then, or something, you play games, and then you do, and then you write, mm-hmm, for like 20 minutes.
I think that's a great exercise. Have all the kids just write whatever comes to, don't be critical at all.
We're not going
to
read it.
Yeah.
You can throw it away if you want.
Yeah, you should. Every teacher should do that. And then you gather all their papers and you throw it all in the bucket and you burn it.
Yeah.
And you just, all the kids watch it burn, like, yeah. Then the next day they'll do it again. They'll write even more freely and not think about being critical about it.
Yeah, kill
then
that.
You burn it again.
Oh, man. Because, like, I was so lucky. I went to a school. I went to an all-boys school for a little while.
Wait, that's like, lucky?
It was great. It was awesome, I got to say. So, 6th, 7th, 8th grade. And every day, we had gym twice a week. And we had intramurals, which was once a week, which was, like, all the boys we had were divided into four houses. So, mm-hmm, like, four gangs, right? Black, gray, blue, and red shirts.
Uh-huh.
And every house had its own captain, and every grade had its own captain. Mm-hmm. So it created different hierarchies of community. So, like, oh, cool, within the 6th grade, you know, got 6 dudes who I'm with who are part of this.
Right.
Click.
Yeah.
But one of them is like the alpha of that click. But
right.
Then it goes up into the 7th and 8th grade. And we would all, and then we would meet once a week, and we'd play like, you know, touch football against each other or basketball or these different things. And it didn't matter if you were good or bad. So you did that, but then we also had gym. And then we also had at least one period a week was just study hall. Mm-hmm. So the very different than the public school setting, because in public school, every moment is regimented where it's like, we need to make sure you get 90 minutes of reading. We need to make sure you get 50 minutes of math. We need to make sure you get an hour a day of science.
Right.
And if you put together all the mandated hours that these kids are supposed to be learning these essentials,
yeah,
they would be, it's every day would be 48 hours of just instruction. Uh-huh. So it's like too many cooks, too many voices, too many special interest groups trying to insert their agenda
uh-huh.
into the day.
Yeah.
When I went to a school where everyone excelled and we had more free time than, but it was like structured free time. It's like, yeah, study hall. During study hall, no one was messing around. Everyone's just reading books or like getting their science projects done.
Well behaved.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we were well behaved because we ran.
That's all it was.
Because we got the gym in earlier, totally. You know?
Yeah, having a kid wake up and just go sit in a desk for 8 hours is tricky.
Right, with the broken water fountain.
Mm-hmm.
So they're like dehydrated and just stuck. And they're like, what do you guys have for lunch? And they're like, we got a juice box and some chips.
Right. Have you taught since you started doing stand-up?
Yeah. So
is that confusing? You're standing in front of a bunch of people and you're like, oh, I'm not supposed to be making jokes.
No, my kids loved me, man, and I think that the stand-up helped a lot because one thing that I always conveyed in the class was just communication.
Mm-hmm.
So you communicate with your whole body. You don't just communicate with your words or people are going to get bored.
Right.
And I would be very good at using voices in the room.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't on, but using your whole body as a tool to convey the message.
Right.
What is the lesson that they need to learn today? How can I get everybody feeling comfortable? When should I modulate my voice?
Mm-hmm.
So like teachers should express anger in their room.
Yeah.
This is going to sound weird, but what I mean by that is teachers should express a range of emotions in the room because by modulating their emotions, they are showing students the range that, they're showing them that it's okay to have that. But you never show your emotions when you're actually feeling them.
Hmm.
So if I'm really angry, that's not the moment that I'm going to like raise my voice.
Because you could scare the kids.
I'm going to count to 10.
Right, right, right.
Calm down. And then maybe later that day, I'm going to like raise my voice when I'm not, when I'm in control of my
right
vessel.
Yep.
And
that
then
makes sense.
Communicate why I'm raising my voice in mm-hmm. the most logical way.
Right.
So that they can see, okay, like, he doesn't play.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, it makes sense. Well, I think there's more energy by what you're holding back. I think just screaming, people are like, whoa, that's crazy. But if you're just like, I'm gonna talk, that like little bit of holding back makes people like, oh my God, I'm on the edge of my seat. Like, what's going to happen?
Yeah, I also learned that silence is the most important.
Mm-hmm.
Silence is so much more effective. I would watch new teachers yell all the time.
Right.
And like, it just becomes this wave of white noise
mm-hmm.
where kids ignore it. They can tune it out.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So the lower, you know, if you're angry and the room is loud, you get lower. You get more quiet.
Right.
And that works in stand-up, too, sometimes,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, if the table's talking.
Yeah, you just start whispering, mm-hmm. and then everybody starts paying attention.
I mean, you learn that in a bar. If a bar's crowded and the music's on, then all of a sudden the music stops. Everyone's just like, people will stop talking because they mm-hmm. become self-conscious or they become conscious.
Yeah. So I've been teaching since then. Now I work with this great organization called the Story Pirates, and I've been with them now for 10 years, and I absolutely love it. Mm-hmm. We go into schools and we teach writing workshops to the whole class, and we take the stories the kids write and we turn them into a show for the entire school to watch.
Oh, wow.
So it's like Saturday Night Live for fourth graders. This is kind of the way that I can describe it. But
so it's just for fourth graders?
No, I mean, we go from kindergarten all the way up to about eighth grade.
You ask them to write a story about something that happened to them in their life, or is it fiction?
We come in with, we have a variety of different formulas or like workshops. So one of the most popular ones is the hero workshop. And we have them define what a hero is. And then over 4 to 5 days, we come up with a quest for this hero to go on. Mm-hmm. And they have a problem to solve that's typically bigger that affects a lot of people. And I try to insert like a social justice component to it. Mm-hmm. So we figure out what some real problems might be that are happening in the world. And I get away from like bullying because I think whatever, it's fine. Other people can talk about that. But like, you know, climate change is a pretty big one, you know, or recycling or something, or graft and corruption. Demagogues. How do we get rid of them? Fake news. How do we stop it?
Real fourth grade material.
Yeah. So it could be like, you know, so a hero can be a grandma. A hero could be a Saint Bernard with a little barrel of hot cocoa attached to its neck.
Uh-huh.
You know, it can be whatever. So we do want them to get fantastical with it, but we take those stories and then and what I noticed was that when I was a public school teacher, I would get 30 to 40% of my students would write if I gave them an assignment. But now when I go into these schools as a teaching artist, I'm getting like 99% engagement.
Yeah.
Because I don't really care about the quality of the work. I care about the quantity.
Right.
And I'm able to access that part of them that excitement to play.
Right.
You know, and it kind of goes back to the morning pages idea with mm-hmm. What if we could get them to write first thing in the day and just tell them it's like disposable.
Yeah.
You know, it's not precious. You don't have to worry about it. I don't care about the misspellings.
Right.
I just care about your ideas.
Yeah. And just getting stuff out.
And once you start getting stuff out, you will want to get better at, you will want to craft it.
Mm,
so once I'm in love with the idea that someone will listen to my ideas, once I know that people will listen, then I can find a way to play, turn editing into play.
Right. Yeah. It's like even a painter. Yeah. Van Gogh has hundreds of paintings where it's just a canvas and blue, where he's just playing on a canvas of different blues.
Yeah.
Before he goes and puts it on a real painting.
I love drawing, and a lot of my drawings, when I sit down, my fiance, she lives with me, and she's always like, oh my God, it's like you did it in one take. She sees the final product, and she's like, you didn't, because I use pens, I don't use pencils beforehand, I don't erase.
Right.
But like a couple weeks ago, she saw like a notebook I had, and inside the notebook, in between the margins, were all of these like little primary sketches so I'd done my calisthenics already.
Right.
I'd done the play.
Right.
So that when it was time to draw it in one sitting, that's all she saw was me doing the drawing in one sitting.
Right.
And she thought it was magic.
and then she saw behind the curtain.
Yeah. And then she saw behind the curtain. She was like, oh. And yeah, that's the thing is like, you gotta, you know, the creative process is just freeing yourself to play.
Mm-hmm. You have to allow yourself, which is tricky because there's the critical mind.
Yeah.
And then there's the mind that wants to play. And they work opposite each other.
Sure. And then the dumbest thing people do is they ask, like, so why are you doing that? Mm-hmm. When you say you want to do something. Like, I like watching monologues on TV, like from movies. And I was like, oh man, I want to learn this Al Pacino monologue from The Devil's Advocate. And people who are not into acting or comedy are like, why?
Yeah.
I'm like, who knows? But you know what? Like sometime at a show in 2 weeks, there might be a moment where someone brings up Al Pacino.
Right.
And then I just shoot up and do that monologue off the dome. And they're like, what?
Yeah. Or it could bring out a new inflection in your voice.
Yeah. Yeah. Just the art. All of this is obsessing. We're just one thing that I admire with comedians or artists in general is just the ability to obsess on something.
And also the ability to be curious.
Yes.
Curiosity. Like, what would happen if I did that? I don't know. Let's see.
Yeah. Take a deep dive into something very specific and pay attention to it and then reappropriate it. And put it in a new context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like I bought this fencing gear last week.
You did?
Yeah. I don't know what I'm going to do with it, but I have it now.
Fencing seems fun.
I just want to watch some YouTube clips on fencing to get started and be like, what is the strategy behind this? Why have people cared about this?
I'm like, why is it not more popular?
Yeah.
It seems way more fun than boxing. I mean, you get to wield a sword and no one dies and no one gets hurt.
Three different types of swords, too. There's like a long sword and like a little dagger and then like a broad, there's a whole bunch of stuff to learn about.
There's a point system, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know anything about it. I was just at a yard sale and this old man, he's a great salesman. You know, I took that from him, but I was like, because clearly he got me to buy some rusty old equipment.
You could bring that into your stand-up. We're just trying to sell these bits anyway.
Yeah, he was peddling his wares, and I was like, yeah. And he's like, I'll give you the whole set. I'll give you this whole setup, this white tunic and a mask and everything for $10. And I was like, yes.
You have to take that.
Yeah.
Do you have another one? I'll fence with you.
I've got two handles. I got to go buy new tips because the old ones were rusty and I was taking the train and I didn't feel like taking weapons on a train with me.
Yeah. Especially as a Mexican.
Yes. Yeah. But yeah, they'd be like, he's going to stab everybody on this train.
And take their jobs.
Yeah. The first thing I do is I poke them, I make them leak, and then I take their jobs.
So, man, I forgot about fencing. I used to be really curious about fencing when I was a kid.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's so funny. I totally forgot about it. I feel like it should be a more popular sport activity.
Sure, sure. Well, now I walk through like South Brooklyn and there's all these new venues that have really esoteric hobbies attached to them. Like there's a place you can throw axes.
Whoa.
Yeah. And it's like a little bar down by Littlefield where you can throw axes.
Real axes.
Yeah.
At a bar.
Uh-huh.
That's like
throwing darts, but you're throwing axes.
That sounds like a terrible idea.
And then like two doors down is like an archery spot where people are just flinging off arrows, shafts.
It's New York City. We have almost everything here pretty much, right?
Yeah. If you Google it, there's a way you can get involved deep in that subculture.
Mm-hmm. Was it a culture shock for you moving here or it's pretty easy from D.C.?
Well, I always lived in East Coast cities.
Mm-hmm.
D.C. is it's a village relative to New York in size, but it's close. There's public transportation. There's buses. There's like, yeah, it didn't feel too much like a culture shock.
Right. Yeah, that's makes sense. And also you already have the exposure to all different ethnic groups there, pretty much.
Yeah. So you hear a lot of jokes about like, nah, there's the subway smells, crazy people. Like, everyone speaks different. It's right. Like, okay, great. Iowa, fine.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Totally.
Yeah.
So you host a couple podcasts.
I do. I got
a show coming up.
I got a bunch of things you just got to keep doing things. That's how you stay in this game for however long, 14 years.
Yeah.
Just keep having new projects. And I have a podcast called Eat, Pray, Judge, which is a movie review podcast that I just put out with my old roommate. And we're on like episode 4. We just talk about a bunch of movies that neither of us had seen growing up, but that have been recommended to us. And so we would take some time as like, you know, men in our 30s to break these films down. And
eating during the podcast.
No, right? No. But we do watch we started watching a bunch of silly rom-coms and now we're moving on to like food movies. A couple of the first podcasts that I think are out or will be out by the time this comes out are Say Anything which was really fun to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Just looking back at the 80s.
Yeah.
And then What Women Want, which is just like a great movie about Mel Gibson with superpowers where he can read women's minds. And so that's one podcast, Eat, Pray, Judge. And that's just fun pop culture nostalgia. And the next one is called The Katie Halper Show. Mm-hmm. And I'm a permanent guest host on that. So she and I, it's a more of a political podcast. We're just Bernie. We are Bernie bros unapologetically.
Mm-hmm.
And we just, you know, I'm looking for like a socialist. I love the Democratic Socialists of America. You know, we interview people like Eric Garner's mom. We talk to her. We interviewed Jill Stein before the election.
Oh, wow.
Sorry. We did. It was great. She was mm-hmm. awesome to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
We interviewed Judah Friedlander, Ted Alexandro in terms of comedy, but Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
You had her on.
Yeah, we had her on.
Rising star.
Yeah, so that's The Katie Halper Show. And so you can find me at Eat, Pray, Judge or The Katie Halper Show. And
or GabePacheco.com.
And everything, all my social media is at GabePacheco.com. And, you know, I'd love to interact with you. So when you're listening to this, just, you know, find me on one of the social media platforms and, let's connect. And if you want to see me live, I'm always at Pete's Candy Store every Wednesday night at 10 PM at Funhouse Comedy.
Yes.
Yeah. And imagine Gary, you've done that show. So
yes.
Yeah. So, you know, it's lit.
You want to hear something neat is that my first date with my fiance was right after I did your show.
Yeah.
And I always tell her, I'm like, if I did well that night,
uh-huh.
I'm like, what would have happened if I would have bombed?
Yeah.
I would have bombed. I walked over to meet her at the Commodore,
uh-huh.
the bar right nearby.
Great burgers at the Commodore.
Mm-hmm. But if I walked in to meet someone on a first date after bombing, I think the date would have gone terribly.
You'd have to, you'd have to walk around the block. You'd have to do a couple laps jogging.
Yeah, I think so.
To just get your energy levels right.
Yeah, so you are intrinsically sewed into my life, whether you knew it or not.
Thank you, Gary, man. That's awesome to hear.
Yeah. Cool. Thanks for coming here and doing this.
Thanks, man.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.